see if this works. Is this a reasonable volume?
It's reasonable.
Good, good, because I'm going to be, it's easier than this one for me. Okay, first, an important announcement. Abraham left a backpack on the bench right outside the classroom here, and it's not there. Did anybody pick it up because they were concerned that it might be... It's just this week, right? It's just a couple of minutes ago. So did anybody see the backpack?
No.
No, that's mine.
Okay. Right, so, okay. The wrong one.
Did you have some maintenance guys?
No, the office isn't open. Let me show you where the maintenance person is. Okay. Don't forget to sign in. Okay, everybody sign in? Okay. All right. We'll be somewhat together today. All right, first thing. I finally got around to starting to record attendance. I have to record each week who's here for our food, so that the state can pay us. And so I was checking off the sign-up sheets, and I realized I hadn't said hello to about three-quarters of you. But I'm very glad that you're here. I went, oh, she's here, he's here, she's here. So it's great to see you, to know that you are here. Thank you for coming. And I'm sorry that I didn't say hello to everybody, each individual as you arrive. And if I don't know you, a few people I don't know, please come up and say hello so that I can match the name and the person. Upcoming classes. We have two more classes in this term besides today. Next week, we skip the 11th, 11-11, school is closed, and we go to the 18th is our last class. So the 4th of November and the 18th of November are our last two classes. You will get an email about that sometime next week. If you don't get the email, it means we don't have your email address, and next week there'll be an opportunity to re-put your email address. So this is a test email to see whether you're on the email list. You will need writing materials and a writing surface for the class on the 18th, because we're going to be doing some stuff that you'll need to, so you need writing materials and some solid surface to write on. I'll remind you of that next week. If you don't know about this, this is the website that Robert has been running for us for years now, swt.org/Spencer. swt.org/Spencer. And on it, you can find all sorts of really good stuff, videos we've seen in class, guests that have been here, video recordings of the class, and audio recordings, which we're doing now. So if you click on audio recordings, you will see, there's a weird sound in this, but you will see a lot of recordings. And down at the bottom, if you click on that, you see Mark Dunlap's recording from last week. Sorry, didn't quite get that right, but okay, so back here. Over here. All right, so I'm sorry, people. God. All right, so that I just wanted to show that to you. SWT.org/Spencer. What, Robert?
I'm sure them the special guest.
Special guest talks?
Right.
But first, I'm going to push the volume of this down way to the dead, and hopefully that'll make a difference. We'll come back. Okay, so these are special talks.
Right, so this is when we had special guests here. So almost every one of these is not in the other one. The only exception is the last two I made a copy to call. But these are organized by the speakers' names. The other folder is mostly the classes like today, where it's just Spencer and there's no guest. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's some pretty amazing people on that list. We have those people in class? Amazing. Amazing. All right, so I just wanted to show that to you. Okay.
SWT.org.
You can put it on there, yeah. / Spencer. I don't.
There's no mark.
I'll do that in a second. Let me get rid of this for now. Let's sit for 10 minutes. A suggestion for sitting is a good habit. A suggestion for sitting is pay special attention to how you feel. Okay? Not necessarily well, how you think and what you're sensing also, but especially how you feel. That's going to be germane to what we're going to do today. So I will see you in 10 minutes. Mindfulness is not about stopping thinking. It's about being aware of what's happening while it's happening. So the usual tendency that we have is to get lost in thought, and especially when we close our eyes, to get lost in thought. The antidote to that is not to try to not get lost in thought. That's another thought, and we'll get you more lost in thought. The antidote to being lost in thought is to allow yourself to think, but return your attention to your breathing or something other than thinking over and over and over again. It typically takes a while before you come out of absorption in thought and become present to what's happening and notice the thoughts that are happening as opposed to being lost in them. The major fault that people, major error that people make when they're trying to be mindful is to try to think their way out of thinking. It's very subtle and very, the thought process wants to hold on. So the way out of that is to simply shift attention over and over again to something other than thinking. What will happen will be the thoughts will become less loud and less constant. And eventually there'll be some time when there's no thought and it's just pure lucid awareness. But you can't create that by trying to brush thoughts away. Okay. Bernie, you had a question.
Yeah, you said before we started, you said keep your mind on how you feel today. So I was thinking about how I was feeling. And I just, everybody's enjoying it. Oh, that's kind of feeling relaxed. So I don't know if that's good or bad.
Okay, if there is nothing, if the only access one has to one's feelings are the thoughts about them, then it's the tip of the iceberg. If the thought that I'm feeling relaxed, I'm feeling calm, I'm feeling happy, connects to an entire organism, an entire body feeling, then that's the full feeling. But the thought process is only part of the larger emotional process. And the way you feel that larger emotional process is you come to your breathing and your full body experience. The feelings generally don't feel like they're in your body, by the way. They feel like they're in front of you. You feel like you take a step back from your experience. So it's like hovering over here as opposed to being inside here.
Thank you.
Welcome. I'm going to shift to the other microphone to do this. But very practically, is there anything that identifies you in the backpack?
No. My phone.
But
your phone. I have some of my books. Yeah. Your book.
But, can you try calling your phone from somebody else's phone?
That would be a really good idea. Because somebody probably picked it up thinking somebody left it here and they don't know who to return it to. It's not, there's no crooks around here, I don't think. It's somebody picked it up preemptively. Mike.
If your phone on iPhone, you can find your phone. Go to, take somebody else's phone, go to the browser, go to the Apple website, and do find my phone, it's your password and all that.
I cannot hear you.
Do you have an iPhone?
Do I have an iPhone? No.
No.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter with a Google phone or Android phone. Find my phone function. We'll show you on a map where your phone is.
Right.
But even before that, call your phone.
Yeah, just try calling.
Call your phone from another phone.
Yeah. Right now, I don't have any access to the internet.
So. No, but there must be somebody here who has a phone.
I'll help you after the class.
Right now.
I might call your phone right now, yeah. Somebody got a phone. Hey, just call your phone.
Give me your
number. Just call your phone, okay. Okay. I don't know how you put this thing on. Okay, so, go,
okay, I'll see the answer.
Okay. So she's going to call a phone in to see if somebody answers it. That's the first step. All right, so on the 16th, our second class on the 16th of September, we talked about two things, the benefits of mindfulness and the nature of the self. You may remember I showed you a three-person video, three different ways of talking about the self. All of them said, the idea that you have a unified self is not accurate. And then I said at the end of that class, I have a few guest speakers lined up, so I'll come back to these topics. Well, we're back to these topics now. So this morning we're going to be talking about the benefits of mindfulness, and then starting a deeper consideration of the nature of the self. and that will continue next week. And then the last, but probably not the last week, because I have some activity I want us all to do on the last week. But at least for these next 2 weeks, we'll be plumbing the depths of the self. So you'll need, we're going to read an article together, and I thought that I would give you the article because it's easier when you see it while I read it. I'm going to read it out loud rather than trying to understand my words entirely. So, that would be fantastic. We need two people, I think. Why don't you take this many, okay? And would you, thank you. This thing is ridiculous. Where do you put this thing? Thank you. So everybody gets one of these. If we could get rid of our illusions, if we could see the world clearly, our suffering would end. And there's more good news. Buddhism offers tools for doing that job. A good example is the type of meditation known as mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation, now practiced by millions of people in the United States and other places far from Buddhism's Asian homeland. Mindfulness meditation, Buddhists say, can change our perspective on feelings such as anxiety and rage, and thereby sap their power to warp our vision and make us suffer. I'm not liking the sound of this. Let's try this one again. Maybe this is better.
Yeah.
This better?
Yes.
All right. Ouch. I'm going to reinvent this thing.
It's just illusory suffering.
Say again?
It's just illusory suffering.
Yeah, it's illusory suffering that you can get rid of either by meditating or throwing the damn thing away. Speaking of illusory suffering, you know, when the person says to the Zen master, it's all illusion, the Zen master steps on that person's toe. I'm going to the reason we're reading this together is because I've got to comment on this every once in a while. Okay. These claims, the bad news and the good, are more than two millennia old, but they're now getting important support from evolutionary psychology, the modern study of how natural selection engineered the human mind. Evolutionary psychology gives Buddhism's diagnosis of the human predicament a backstory. It explains why humans are prone to illusions and to suffering, and why the two problems are related. And this explanation can strengthen the Buddhist prescription, adding to the power of mindfulness meditation in particular. So evolutionary psychology is why we have the mind we have, what it has done for us in terms of survival and procreation. So from an evolutionary psychology point of view, everything you think, feel, and do was selected for because it helped our ancestors to survive and procreate. So evolutionary psychology asks the question, why? Why this, why that, why the other thing? Okay.
Does it deal with the unconscious?
Why we have an unconscious? Yeah, it deals with all of our functions. So the idea is we have to process a huge amount of information, and we couldn't do that consciously. We have a very limited capacity to process information consciously, so we have to process a lot of it non-consciously. So yeah. Mindfulness meditation is an exercise in attention. It involves calming the mind, typically by focusing on the breath, and then using the resulting equanimity to observe things with unusual care and clarity. So we calm down and we see things more clearly. The things observed can include sounds, physical sensations, or anything else in the field of awareness. But perhaps most important is the careful observation of feelings, because feelings play such a powerful role in guiding our perceptions, thoughts, and behaviors. So notice he's emphasizing feelings here as underlying the way we perceive and the way we think. And feelings are typically not very, emotions in my word, my way of saying, are typically not conscious. They're only conscious occasionally when they're very big. So we're mostly walking around in the periphery of our experience, our sensations and our thoughts, as opposed to the whole organism's response to being alive. And here's where an evolutionary perspective can be helpful. Mindfulness calls for a kind of skepticism toward the feelings. Rather than automatically following their guidance, you critically inspect them and decide which ones to trust. Evolutionary psychology helps to explain why this skepticism is warranted, why so many human feelings are unreliable guides. Stop here for a second. So this is not about follow your heart. This is about see what your heart is saying and then decide whether that is worth following or not. We don't generally think of Darwin and the Buddha as being on the same wavelength, but in this and other ways, their worldviews turn out to harmonize nicely. So I'll say just a tiny bit now, he's going to say more, but I'll say a tiny bit now about why you don't necessarily follow your heart. Your emotions, your setting of your body, your setting of your whole organism in every moment to anticipate the next moment depends upon what you have learned in the past about this moment and similar moments. So you expect what's going to happen based on what has happened in the past in this setting. Sometimes this setting is now different than settings in the past, and your reaction from the past would lead you astray. That is, this setting, even though it resembles settings back there, is calling for a different response. So your emotions are just telling you to do the habitual thing in this setting or in this situation. The habitual thing sometimes works and sometimes is not the best course of action. Does that make sense to people? I mean, that's what emotions are. Emotions are, okay, I feel this way, I should do this in this life situation. Mike.
That requires analysis. Analysis requires thinking. So now we're back to thinking about our emotions and our feelings.
Yeah, thinking is a good thing. You just don't want to do it to the exclusion of everything else. But yeah, there's a reason that we think. Thinking allows us to make different decisions than we would make based on our history. It allows us to change course more appropriately. The Darwinian account of the human situation, like the Buddhist account, begins with bad news. The process that created us, natural selection, is indifferent to whether we are happy or sad, enlightened or deluded. Ultimately, natural selection cares only about one thing, or I should say cares in quotes, since natural selection is just a blind process, not a conscious designer. And that one thing is getting genes into the next generation. Genetically based mental traits, including particular feelings, that in the past contributed to genetic proliferation have flourished, while traits that didn't have fallen by the wayside. Whether those feelings and the thoughts and perceptions those feelings shape give us a true view of reality is, strictly speaking, beside the point. So is whether they make us happy or miserable. So we have evolved not to see reality truly. We have evolved to see reality in the way that helps us survive and procreate. And whether we're happy or miserable is unimportant. What's important from evolution's point of view, what's important is that we survive and procreate. I think, by the way, that's not exactly true. I think there's an evolutionary advantage to being happy. And we'll get there. Okay. Which is why evolutionary psychology is not the whole story. Okay. Take anxiety, for example. Just in case. Okay. Evolutionary psychologists consider anxiety to be natural, grounded in our genes. After all, worrying about things can lead you to do something about those things. If you worry that your toddler, who seems to have wandered off somewhere, may get devoured by a beast, you'll go make sure your toddler is safe, which, not incidentally, means making sure that copies of your genes are safe. Of course, anxiety is unpleasant. But natural selection doesn't care about that. It doesn't even care that some of this unpleasantness will be for naught, that your toddler turned out to be in the hut next door. And the nightmare scenario that for a moment seemed so real was all in your head. Better safe than sorry from natural selection's point of view. False positives are a feature, not a bug, even though they make you suffer by fostering an illusion. So he's saying that worst case scenarios are natural because they preserve life. And that he's not saying, but that the smarter you are, probably the worse you're going to make yourself feel in this regard, because you're going to anticipate all the possible things that can go wrong. You know, according to evolutionary psychology, our natural anxieties include social anxieties, the ancestral environment, the hunter-gatherer milieu in which humans evolved, featured lots of social interaction, and this interaction had consequences for a person's genes. If you had low status in the group and few friends, then that cut your chances of spreading your genes, so impressing people mattered. So we from a very early point in our evolution, we care about how other people look at us, because it has something to do with how well we will do in terms of survival appropriation. Similarly, if your offspring didn't thrive socially, that boded ill for their reproductive prospects, and hence for your genes. So it made sense in Darwinian terms for our ancestors to worry about what people thought of them and their offspring. Here too, false positives could arise. Our ancestors presumably worried about some things in their social environment that turned out not to be worth worrying about. But we moderns have things even worse. The false positive problem can be compounded by the fact that anxiety no longer operates in the environment for which natural selection designed it. Consider an artifact that has never been found by archaeologists, unearthing the remnants of a Paleolithic hunter-gatherer village. PowerPoint. Never been found in ancient times. Okay? One thing our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't do was give presentations to an audience consisting largely of people they didn't know. Maybe that's why the prospect of doing this fills some people with overwhelming anxiety. Anxiety is designed for a fairly small and intimate social environment, yet amplified by an environment that is neither. So we're accustomed to talking to the 30 people in our extended family group. You know, and we don't get too anxious about that. But when we think about talking to a lot of people that we don't know, well, whether it's a lot of people that we don't know or whether it's anybody that we don't know, there's an anxiety that comes from that. This doesn't mean that anxiety about public speaking is worthless. Worrying about your PowerPoint presentation can lead to a better presentation. But let's face it, though this anxiety is sometimes productive, it often isn't. There are people who, before a presentation, are beset by images of themselves spontaneously vomiting while talking to a crowd, even though, come to think of it, they've never spontaneously vomited while talking to a crowd. In a particularly perverse twist on PowerPoint anxiety, I've been known to lie awake the night before a big presentation, worrying that if I don't get to sleep, I'll do a bad job the next day. I can't relate to that at all. I defy anyone to argue that this is natural selection's way of increasing my chances of surviving and reproducing. So too with other modern social anxieties, a sense of dread before going to a cocktail party that in fact is unlikely to lead to anything worth dreading, or worrying about how your child is doing at her first slumber party, something you're powerless to influence. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't have to navigate rooms full of people they had never met, or send their children off in homes they had never seen. That presumably is why these occasions can bring powerful, yet typically unproductive anxiety. This mismatch between our evolved nature and the environment in which we find ourselves isn't just a modern phenomenon. For thousands of years, there have been social environments that weren't the ones people were designed for. The Buddha was born to a royal family, which means that he lived in a society with clusters of population much bigger than a hunter-gatherer village. And there is evidence that people were being called on to speak before large audiences, and that something like PowerPoint anxiety had taken shape. In one discourse, the Buddha's list of common fears included the, quote, fear of embarrassment in assemblies, end quote. So this has been a problem as long as people went from small familial groups to larger congregations. But I want to say one more thing about this, which he doesn't say. We have anxieties now about things that aren't proximal to us. That is, because we have all this media, we can have anxiety about things happening around the world that could have effect on us. So the amount of stuff we can be anxious about is exponentially multiplying. There's no end to what there is to worry about. You know? And you see that in the youth who are more plugged in and so have much more anxiety. And there's a direct correlation between how plugged in they are and how much anxiety they feel, which is they're plugged in all the time and they're completely anxious all the time, sort of. Not all, but a significant number of our youth are really freaked out.
What about the nuclear anxieties 50 years ago?
Well, we were already plugged in at that point, but it went away. Now there's always something, and it's not just on the TV. The TV goes with you. The TV is never not there. All right. That people were, even in the Buddha's day, experiencing an uncomfortable mismatch between their environment, between the environment their feelings were engineered for and the environment in which they found themselves, may help to explain the Buddhism's early emphasis on meditative practice. The meditation that is described in ancient texts would have made people more aware of their feelings, in a sense more objectively aware of them, and so less reflexively governed by them. This remains a central goal of mindfulness meditation today, being more aware of how you're feeling and less identified with it, less determined by it. And it can work. I have a daily meditation practice, periodically recharged by silent meditation retreats of a week or more, and I have more than once used meditation to deal with intense anxiety. In the middle of the night before a big talk, I had even sat up in bed, meditated, and gotten to a point where I viewed a knot of anxiety with such calm objectivity that it might as well have been a piece of abstract art I was contemplating in a museum. It entirely lost its grip on me, after which it disappeared. Perhaps Buddhism, more than two millennia ago, had much the same experience. Perhaps Buddhists, more than two millennia ago, had much the same experience when meditating on fear of speaking in assemblies. So I want to say something about this, which is when you're really upset, in any way, and you think, I should meditate now, and you think, oh God, I'm way too upset to sit down and meditate, give me a break, it'll never work. And then if you sit yourself down to meditate, you think, this will never work, I'm way too upset, I can't even find my breathing, I should just get up. Persist, keep doing it. Keep trusting your practice, that's why you've practiced. Keep coming back to your breathing no matter what is happening. No matter if the roof is falling down. No matter if the water is flooding in. Physically, take care of yourself. But for any other reason, just keep coming back to your breathing and trusting your practice. In my experience, what will happen is, sooner or later, you will come out of absorption in that tornado, in that hurricane, and you will find yourself in the eye of the storm. The storm will still be there, but you will be freed from that kind of caught-upness, and you'll be perfectly okay, sun is shining, in the middle of this hurricane. And then if you stay there for a while, the hurricane spontaneously will calm down. But that's why you practice, so that when things are really tough, you can trust your practice. Okay. And when things are really tough, you better have done a reasonably good amount of practice.
Just very briefly. When you say just do your breathing, follow your breathing, you mentally think about inhaling, exhale, or you just watch?
Okay, some people use various mental techniques like a mantra,
yeah,
or other techniques, count their breathing, for example. You could do that if it helps you, if it's your normal practice. I like to just focus on the actual physical sensations because I want my mind to calm down, so I don't want to feed it in any way. It gets noisy.
So just be aware of your breathing.
Yeah, I just sometimes put my hand on my belly and just feel my belly, and just every time my attention goes away, I come back to my belly going like this.
You know. Thank you.
All right, so. There is no doubt, however, that the modern environment surpasses the Buddha's environment in its power to warp our feelings about, hence our perception of, the world. Consider powdered sugar donuts. So what he's going to say now is we're in a little different environment now with more delusional, more power to cause our brain to not work the way it should. Okay, consider powdered sugar donuts. I have warm feelings toward them. So warm that if I were guided only by my feelings, I would eat them for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and three meal snacks. Yet I'm told that eating that many donuts would be bad for me, that my feelings of attraction to powdered sugar donuts is not to be trusted. This is hard news to take. How could natural selection let something like this happen? Give me feelings that don't even do a good job of taking care of the body containing my genes. Well, natural selection designed our feelings for an environment with no junk food, an environment in which the sweetest thing available was fruit, and not the kind of fruit we eat, which is hybridized, okay? So a sweet tooth and the feelings it inspires served us well. But in the modern world, which features the achievement of culinary science known as empty calories, these feelings are misleading. So I gotta talk a little bit about addiction. You know, I've said this before, so I'll just talk about it super briefly. In our brain, in the middle of our brain, in the limbic system, there is something called the reward pathway. It works on the neurotransmitter dopamine. When you taste something good, or you do something pleasurable, of any kind, like shop for pleasure, or porn, or whatever else you do to give you pleasure, that's not in the natural environment, but it's something that humans have recently cooked up. Back up. Anytime that you do something pleasurable, your brain produces some neurotransmitters called endorphins that say, that was good. And then the reward pathway says, do that again. We want more of that. It was pleasant. So the reward pathway motivates you to do it again. Then the brain releases its endorphins saying, that was good. And then the reward pathway says, more. And in nature, that which is pleasurable, it indicates that which will increase life. That's why you have these mechanisms in the brain to get you to eat more of that which will make you stay alive. And because life back then was feast and famine, you want to eat a whole lot of that stuff if possible, because there might be times when you don't get anything to eat. So the reward pathway in nature for animals works very well. It gets them toward that which feels good, which is that which preserves and increases life. That's why it's there. But human beings have invented things that fool these brain mechanisms. They are very pleasurable, and they make you have a very strong impulse to do them again. Things like drugs, and all these other things that we get addicted to, which promise to help us, but actually hurt us. So these are ways that we have invented to give us pleasure, unnatural pleasures, which actually work against survival appropriation. And the problem is they're all over the place and everybody has them. Different people have different things that they do that they know they shouldn't do, but they are impelled to do them by this set of brain mechanisms. So powdered sugar donuts are just one of these ways that we can misbehave. Yeah.
Have you heard that called a supernormal stimulus?
Yeah, that's a supernormal stimulus here. Something that works more powerfully than our brain knows how to deal with. Yeah. Okay. So, or should I say more misleading? Fundamental to Buddhism is the idea that craving in general, tanha, as it's called in ancient texts, is inherently misleading. That is, I'll let him say it. So it doesn't matter whether these are sugar donuts, unnatural pleasures, or natural pleasures, there's something inherently unsatisfying about pleasure. Regardless of what we thirst after, junk food, healthful food, sex. The thirst, the tanha, fosters an illusion of enduring gratification. When I see anything tasty, I imagine how good it will taste, not how that satisfaction will inevitably fade, leading to the desire for more. This is one of the Buddha's main messages, that the pleasures we seek evaporate quickly and leave us thirsting for more. We spend our time looking for the next gratifying thing, the next donut, the next sexual encounter, the next status-enhancing promotion, the next online purchase, but the thrill always fades, and it always leaves us wanting more. The old Rolling Stones lyric, "I can't get no satisfaction," is, according to Buddhism, the human condition. Though the Buddha is famous for asserting that life is full of suffering, some scholars say that's an incomplete rendering of his message, and that the word translated as suffering, dukkha, could be translated as unsatisfactoriness. From natural selections of Jeanette.
So I wonder if technology addiction for more information falls under that. You know, there's more and more information that people research in technology through phones and apps and laptops and iPads.
So it goes two ways. There are two reasons why it's addictive to technology. Addictive. One reason is because, like slot machines, it promises a payoff every once in a while. If I keep looking at my text, eventually I'm going to get one I really like. And even if I don't get one, somebody else is going to get one, you know. And that's why slot machines work. Not that you get paid off occasionally, but the lights go on in the casino, and somebody gets paid off, and you think it could be me. So surrogately, you're getting paid off. So one reason that you keep on your phone is in anticipation of something good happening. But the other reason that you stay on your phone and on devices is because if you're aware of what could eat you, then you can avoid it. Well, there's always something that could eat you, so every time there's something that is like that, you orient toward it. You have to think about it. What should I do about that? And so being like this, being glued to the TV because they keep changing what's coming at you, you can't get away because you're just impelled to, that could get me, what do I do with that, what do I do with that? So because of what you're attracted to and what you're threatened by, you spend more and more time gathering information. The one who has the most information has the most chance of surviving, approaching opportunity and avoiding threat. Right? The more information I have, the more opportunities I go to, the more threats I can avoid. So even without Silicon Valley's incredibly inventive ways of keeping us addicted, those things would keep us addicted. They're just better at keeping us addicted. So, from natural selection's point of view, dooming an animal to relentlessly recurring unsatisfactoriness is a wonderful idea. After all, if pleasure didn't subside, we'd never seek it again. Our first meal would be our last, because hunger would never return. So too with sex, a single act of intercourse, and then a lifetime of lying there basking in the afterglow. That's no way to get lots of genes into the next generation. Contentment is maxed while it lasts, but it evaporates by design. So evolution keeps us moving forward to survive and procreate. Okay. Much in the modern world, from junk food to pornography to nicotine to the Facebook algorithm that governs your news feed, has been engineered to intensify tanha, our unquenchable desire for more. What to do? One approach is to meditate.
Observe
particular cravings mindfully, thus weakening them. This is challenging, more challenging than meditating on anxiety, I'd say, but there's evidence that it can work. A study involving 88 smokers, published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence in 2011 found that this kind of mindfulness training more effectively treated nicotine addiction than the American Lung Association's Freedom from Smoking program, which offers group counseling and a menu of therapies such as nicotine patches. So it turns out that even for very strong cravings, being mindful of them seems to have a salubrious effect and sometimes a dramatically freeing effect. There's a guy named G. Allen Marlatt, who was the world expert on addictions until he died, but he was at the University of Washington. He used to use cognitive behavioral therapy to help people with really severe addictions like the meth and heroin and severe alcohol addiction. And he changed to mindfulness late in his career. He said, if I can teach people to watch the impulse as opposed to being absorbed by, you know, governed by the impulse, then I can teach them to not do the things that would hurt them. And Marshall Linehan at the University of Washington devised something called dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, which was initially used for people with personality disorders, especially borderline personality disorders, which we used to think was untreatable. But now it's used for everything, DBT. And DBT is based on Marshall Linehan's many years of doing Zen meditation.
Sorry, what is it again? DBT is what?
Dialectical Behavior Therapy, DBT. It's really popular. And what Marshall Linehan decided is to help people with various impulses that were not helpful and even self-destructive, to get them to be able to notice those impulses without immediately being drawn into acting on those impulses. So these approaches that use mindfulness have to do with decoupling impulse from action. Typically, you have an impulse and you do it. You have an impulse to scratch your head, you scratch your head. You have an impulse to light a cigarette, you light a cigarette. You have an impulse to eat something, you eat it. This is a question of being aware of the impulse and then making a decision about whether to do it. And with practice, that's what mindfulness is. It's a process of watching how you're operating and making decisions about how best to operate based on that. Tell me your first name.
Barbara.
Barbara, yeah.
So mindfulness trumps physiology?
I don't know. First of all, I don't use that word anymore.
I know, neither do I, but I'm up with another word.
The word is out of my vocabulary. What it does is it gives you a way to modify automatic physiology. What we say about mindfulness is you usually work on automatic pilot. Mindfulness is becoming aware of how you're working so that you can either choose to work on automatic pilot or you can change the workings in various ways. You can notice what you're saying to yourself and you can say, hey, I'm saying something to myself that isn't true and isn't helpful. It's just depressing me. I could change what I say to myself and that would change how I felt and how I acted. That's called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, right? So mindfulness says you watch your physiology, including your thoughts, that part of your physiology, and then you either allow them to govern your behavior when they're useful, or you change your behavior consciously when they're not useful. You sit inside yourself, see how you're wired. When it's fine, you just let it happen. When it's not fine, you change the wiring. That's what mindfulness is. It's a meta-therapy. It's beyond therapy. It's a whole different way to operate. Leon.
How do you spell E. Allen's last name?
Say again?
E. Allen.
Marlatt.
Mar?
M-A-R-L-A-T-T.
Thank you.
G, I think, is his first name. G is his first initial. G. Allen Marlatt. M-A-R-L-A-T-T.
Thank you.
Okay. right, so we're just about done with this. This is all a preamble to where I'm supposedly going today, but we'll see. Yeah, we can still go there, okay. Regular mindfulness meditation can also undermine craving in a more general way. It can lessen the urgency of finding the next big thing by deepening your appreciation of things that you already have. It can satisfy you so you're not constantly looking for other satisfactions. Buddhism's list of unfortunate human illusions is long. It includes misconceptions about the self that we think of as being at our core, and misconceptions about the nature of the things that we see in the world, including other humans. And many of these illusions can plausibly be explained as having been implanted in us by natural selection to serve its agenda, an agenda that doesn't put a priority on seeing the world as it actually is, or on finding lasting happiness in the world that we do see. It is a tribute to Buddhism that it sized up the human predicament more than two millennia before science got around to discovering the origins of that predicament. But it would be unlike the Buddha to boast about this. If he were around today, he might instead thank Darwin for the corroboration for explaining how humans wound up being prone to illusion and to attendant suffering. And if Darwin were around today and joined the mindfulness meditation movement, he might thank the Buddha for coming up with a way to address the problem. I thought it was a cute article and brought out some interesting stuff. So now let's move to, All right, I'm going to do this. Let's get rid of this. I hate it.
It worked very well.
Okay, so really quickly. Other things besides mindfulness that you can do to counteract the anxiety and unsatisfactoriness that we just talked about. One thing is you can consciously change how you look at the world. We talked about the negativity bias before, the idea that you're selectively, if you leave yourself alone, you selectively attend to what could go wrong. Threat is more important than opportunity. You miss an opportunity, there's always another one. If you miss a threat, you could not be here anymore. So the brain is always scanning at a non-conscious level for where's the opportunity and especially where's the threat. And if there's any possibility of threat, the brain focuses on that. So it's called the negativity bias, and what it means is as you walk around in the world, you get more and more unhappy because you're more and more aware of the potential things that could go wrong. Kids are not terribly unhappy, but they're happy because they don't realize, but when you get to be an adult, you realize all the stuff that could fall down. The way to rebalance yourself is by consciously making the effort to look for what's right, as opposed to being stuck on being preoccupied with what's wrong. So on a conscious level, you direct your attention and your thoughts to that which is uplifting, to balance out the non-conscious preoccupation with what could go wrong. This is called positive psychology. And it's why positive psychology is such a big deal. The idea that if you just walk around normally, it's anxiety-producing and unsatisfactory. You kind of got to walk around and say to yourself, I got to look for what's good here, and I got to think of the opportunities as well as the threats, and I got to be satisfied with things as they are. And if you practice these ways of thinking, you rebalance yourself. Otherwise, you stay alive and unhappy. Okay. Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, said, if you really want to be happy, don't be a hedonist. That is, don't base your happiness on pleasures, because those pleasures are all going to fade and they're going to leave you wanting a pleasure, the next pleasure. And it's going to be a constant thing of getting something and then having the pleasure fade, getting the next pleasure. So you're running all the time for things which never really satisfy you.
or don't satisfy you for very long. So Aristotle said the way to be more happy is to be eudaimonic rather than hedonic, to do what's called eudaimonia, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is based on living in a worthwhile, virtuous way. He said if you are less concerned about momentary pleasure and more concerned about living a meaningful, deep, considered life, your happiness won't fade. You'll be basing your life not on things that dissolve in your hand, but rather on the deep connection you have to other people and to being alive. So he said the life to live is a life of virtue, a life where you do the things that will that have real worth. Now, what those things are, there are various formulations for virtue. I'm not going to go there right now because that's a whole other thing. But you know the difference. You might do something that, for example, you might do something like volunteer for or do something for to help other people. Like maybe you volunteer at the homeless shelter or something like that. That's not necessarily pleasurable, but when you get out, when you leave your job that you did volunteering, you feel really good. You feel like you did something that really was worthwhile, and that feeling stays with you. So the idea is, if you do things that another way to look at this is, if you focus beyond yourself, you do better than if you only focus on yourself. But that's a whole other conversation. Colette.
Yeah, the famous anthropologist Richard Turner said the ultimate experience is communitas. Not community. You know what communitas is? It's in community on a soul level, not on a hierarchy level. And when people experience communitas, yeah, like what happened in New York after 9/11, right, that it instigated communitas,
yeah,
that people the rest of their life are looking for, they need that more than anything else.
So indeed, Richard Turner says it's communitas, a deep relationship to other people.
On a soul level.
On a soul level.
But not on a hierarchy level.
Got it.
In communitas, hierarchy disappears.
Got it.
And people are all one. That's why I use 9/11, yeah, New York as an example.
Well, which totally leveled things out,
yeah,
for people.
The,
yeah,
the street sweeper is as important as the Lord Mayor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that is the ultimate experience. But we don't have that. And you can't create it. Communism was an attempt,
yeah,
to create communitas.
And it didn't work.
It didn't work,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
It happened spontaneously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good thought. I can't pursue it, but that's a really good thought. Where I need to do something now, I need to show you a video, which is going to be about 20 minutes long. Yeah. So I'll do that right now, and then I'll make like about 3 minutes worth of comment at the end that will is where I'm leading. Okay, but I want to show you this video to make the point about the comment that I'm going to make. Because the question is, what is the self? We're moving to the question of what is the self? And I'm going to answer a question for many of us that I couldn't have answered without work like you're going to see. Okay? But it's a really important question. But first let me show you this, and then I'll tell you what the question is and what the answer is. Okay? So we need
yeah, less lighting. knows where the volume is. Let's try that.
A few of you will recognize this. I showed this some years ago. This is Antonio Damasio of USC talking about who we are.
The Tempur-Pedic Breeze makes sleep feel cool because the Tempur-Breeze transfers heat away from your body, so you feel cool night after night. Experience a mattress ranked number one in customer satisfaction by J.D. Power 3 years in a row.
We're here to talk about the wonder and the mystery of conscious minds.
Why can't I get my closed captions? Sometimes a license.
Oh, you have to click on upper right.
Yeah, I'm trying to, but it moves around me. There we go. All right. Uh-huh. Mystery of conscious minds. Okay, let's go back to the here. I hope we don't
have to. We're here to talk about the wonder and the mystery of conscious minds. The wonder is about the fact that we all woke up this morning and we had with it the amazing return of our conscious mind. We recovered minds with a complete sense of self and a complete sense of our own existence. And we hardly ever pause to consider this what...
Okay, you can't read those things, right? Because it's too small?
Yeah.
Can I take them off? They're totally distracting.
No, we can read them.
Oh, you can read them?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So we woke up this morning knowing that we had a sense of self.
We should, in fact, because without having this possibility of conscious minds, we would have no knowledge whatsoever about our humanity. We would have no knowledge whatsoever about the world. We would have no pains, but also no joys. We would have no access to love or to the ability to create. And of course, Scott Fitzgerald said famously that he who invented consciousness would have a lot to be blamed for, but he also forgot that without consciousness he would have no access to true happiness and even to the possibility of transcendence. So much for the wonder. Now for the mystery. This is a mystery that has really been extremely hard to elucidate all the way back into early philosophy and certainly throughout the history of neuroscience. This has been one mystery that has always resisted elucidation, has caused major controversies, and there are actually many people that think that we should not even touch it, we should just leave it alone, it's not to be solved. I don't believe that, and I think the situation is changing. It would be ridiculous to claim that we know how we make consciousness in our brains, but we certainly can begin to approach the question, and we can begin to see the shape of a solution. And one more wonder to celebrate is the fact that we have imaging technologies that now allow us to go inside the human brain and be able to do, for example, what you're seeing right now. These are images that come from Hanna Damasio's lab and which show you in a living brain the reconstruction of that brain. And this is a person who is alive. This is not a person that is being studied at autopsy. And even more, and this is something that one can be really amazed about, is what I'm going to show you next, which is going underneath the surface of the brain and actually looking in the living brain at real connections, real pathways. So all of those colored lines correspond to bunches of axons, the fibers that join cell bodies to synapses, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, they don't come in color, but at any rate, they are there, the colors are the codes for the direction, for whether it is back to front or vice versa. At any rate, what is consciousness? What is a conscious mind? And we could take a very simple view and say, well, it is that which we lose when we fall into deep sleep without dreams, or when we go under anesthesia, and it is what we regain when we recover from sleep or from anesthesia. But what is exactly that stuff that we lose under anesthesia or when we are in deep dreamless sleep? Well, first of all, it is a mind, which is a flow of mental images. And of course, consider images that can be sensory patterns, visual, such as you're having right now in relation to the stage and me, or auditory images, as you're having now in relation to my words. That flow of mental images is mind. But there is something else that we're all experiencing in this room. We are not passive exhibitors of visual or auditory or tactile images. We have selves. We have a me that is automatically present in our minds right now. We own our minds, and we have a sense that it's every one of us that is experiencing this, not the person who is sitting next to you. So in order to have a conscious mind, you have a self within the conscious mind. So a conscious mind is a mind with a self in it. The self introduces a subjective perspective in the mind, and we are only fully conscious when self comes to mind. So what we need to know to even address this mystery is, number one, how minds are put together in the brain, and number two, how selves are constructed. Now, the first part, the first problem, is relatively easy. It's not easy at all, but it is something that has been approached gradually in neuroscience. And it's quite clear that in order to make minds, we need to construct neural maps. So imagine a grid like the one I'm showing you right now. And now imagine within that grid, that two-dimensional sheath, imagine neurons. And picture, if you will, a billboard, a digital billboard, where you have elements that can be either lit or not. And depending on how you create the pattern of lighting or not lighting the digital elements, or for that matter, the neurons in the sheath, you're going to be able to construct a map. This is, of course, a visual map that I'm showing you, but this applies to any kind of map, auditory, for example, in relation to sound frequencies, or to the maps that we construct with our skin in relation to an object that we palpate. Now, to bring home the point of how close it is, the relationship between the grid of neurons and the topographical arrangement of the activity of the neurons and our mental experience, I'm going to tell you a personal story. So if I cover my left eye, I'm talking about me personally, not all of you. If I cover my left eye, I look at the grid pretty much like the one I'm showing you. Everything is nice and fine and perpendicular. But some time ago, I discovered that if I cover my left eye, instead, what I get is this. I look at the grid and I see a warping at the edge of my central left field. Very odd, I've analyzed this for a while, but some time ago, through the help of an ophthalmologist colleague of mine, Carmen Pugliafito, who developed a laser scanner of the retina, I found out the following. If I scan my retina through the horizontal plane that you see there in the little corner, what I get is the following. On the right side, my retina is perfectly symmetrical. You see the going down towards the fovea, where the optic nerve begins, but on my left retina, there is a bump, which is marked there by the red arrow, and it corresponds to a little cyst that is located below. And that is exactly what causes the warping of my visual image. So just think of this. You have a grid of neurons, and now you have a plain mechanical change in the position of the grid, and you get a warping of your mental experience. So this is how close your mental experience and the activity of the neurons in the retina, which is a part of the brain located in the eyeball, or for that matter, a sheath of visual cortex. So from the retina, you go on to visual cortex, and of course, the brain adds on a lot of information to what is going on in the signals that come from the retina. And in that image there, you see a variety of islands of what I call image-making regions in the brain. You have the green, for example, that corresponds to tactile information, or the blue that corresponds to auditory information. And something else that happens is that those image-making regions, where you have the plotting of all these neural maps, can then provide signals to this ocean of purple that you see around, which is the association cortex, where you can make records of what went on in those islands of image making. And the great beauty is that you can then go from memory out of those association cortices and produce back images in the very same regions that have perception. So think about how wonderfully convenient and lazy the brain is. So it provides certain areas for perception and image making, and those are exactly the same that are going to be used for image making when we recall information. So far, the mystery of the conscious mind is diminishing a little bit because we have a general sense of how we make these images. But what about the self? The self is really the elusive problem. And for a long time, people did not even want to touch it, and because they said, how can you have this sort of reference point, this stability that is required to maintain the continuity of cells day after day? And I thought about a solution to this problem is the following. We generate brain maps of the body's interior and use them as the reference for all other maps. So let me tell you just a little bit about how I came to this. I came to this because if you're going to have a reference that we know as self, the me, the I in our own processing, we need to have something that is stable, something that does not deviate much from day to day. Well, it so happens that we have a singular body. We have one body, not two, not three. And so that's the beginning. There is just one reference point, which is the body. But then, of course, the body has many parts, and things grow at different rates, and they have different sizes in different people. However, not so with the interior. The things that have to do with what is known as our internal milieu, for example, the whole management of the chemistries within our body, are in fact extremely maintained day after day for one very good reason. If you deviate too much in the parameters that are close to the midline of that life-permitting survival range, you go into disease or death. So we have an inbuilt system within our own lives that ensures some kind of continuity. I like to call it an almost infinite sameness from day to day. Because if you don't have that sameness physiologically, you're going to be sick or you're going to die. So that's one more element for this continuity. And the final thing is that there is a very tight coupling between the regulation of our body within the brain and the body itself, unlike any other coupling. So, for example, I'm making images of you, but there's no physiological bond between the images I have of you as an audience and my brain. However, there is a close, permanently maintained bond between the body regulating parts of my brain and my own body. So here's how it looks. Look at the region there. There is the brain stem in between the cerebral cortex and the spinal cord, and it is within that region that I'm going to highlight now that we have this housing of all the life regulation devices of a body. This is so specific that, for example, if you look at the part that is colored in red in the upper part of the brainstem, if you damage that as a result of a stroke, for example, what you get is coma or vegetative state, which is a state, of course, in which your mind disappears, your consciousness disappears. And what happens then actually is that you lose the grounding of the self, you have no longer access to any feeling of your own existence, and in fact there can be images going on, being formed in the cerebral cortex, except you don't know they're there. You have, in effect, lost consciousness when you have damage to that red section of the brainstem. But if you consider the green part of the brainstem, nothing like that happens. It is that specific. So in that green component of the brainstem, if you damage it, and often it happens, what you get is complete paralysis, but your conscious mind is maintained. You feel, you know, you have a fully conscious mind that you can report very indirectly. It's a horrific condition. You don't want to see it. And people are, in fact, imprisoned within their own bodies, but they do have a mind.
There was a very interesting film, one of the rare good films done about a situation like this, by Julian Schnabel some years ago, about a patient that was in that condition. So, now I'm going to show you a picture. I promise not to say anything about this, except this is to frighten you. It's just to tell you that in that red section of the brainstem, there are, to make it simple, all those little squares that correspond to modules that actually make brain maps of different aspects of our interior, different aspects of our body. They are exquisitely topographic, and they are exquisitely interconnected in a recursive pattern. And it is out of this, and out of this tight coupling between the brainstem and the body, that I believe, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, that you generate this mapping of the body that provides the grounding for the self, and that comes in the form of feelings. Primordial feelings, by the way. So what is the picture that we get here? Look at cerebral cortex, look at brainstem, look at body, and you get a picture of the interconnectivity in which you have the brainstem providing the grounding for the self in a very tight interconnection with the body, and you have the cerebral cortex providing the great spectacle of our minds with the profusion of images that are in fact the contents of our minds and that we normally pay most attention to, as we should, because that's really the film that is rolling in our minds. But look at the arrows, they're not there for looks, they're there because there's this very close interaction. You cannot have a conscious mind if you don't have the interaction between cerebral cortex and brainstem. You cannot have a conscious mind if you don't have the interaction between the brainstem and the body. Another thing that is interesting is that the brainstem that we have is shared with a variety of other species. So throughout vertebrates, the design of the brainstem is very similar to ours, which is one of the reasons why I think those other species have conscious minds like we do, except that they're not as rich as ours because they don't have a cerebral cortex like we do. That's where the difference is, and I strongly disagree with the idea that consciousness should be considered as the great product of the cerebral cortex. Only the wealth of our minds is, not the very fact that we have a self that we can refer to our own existence and that we have any sense of a person. Now, there are three levels of self to consider, the proto, the core, and the autobiographical. The first two are shared with many, many other species, and they are really coming out largely of the brainstem and whatever there is of cortex in those species. It's the autobiographical self, which some species have. I think cetaceans and primates have also an autobiographical self to a certain degree, and everybody's dogs at home have an autobiographical self to a certain degree. But the novelty is here. The autobiographical self is built on the basis of past memories and memories about the plans that we have made. It's the lived past and the anticipated future. And the autobiographical self has prompted extended memory, reasoning, imagination, creativity, and language, and out of that came the instruments of culture, religions, justice, trade, the arts, science, technology. And it is within that culture that we really can get, and this is the novelty, something that is not entirely set by our biology. It is developed in the cultures, it is developed in collectives of human beings. And this is, of course, the culture where we have developed something that I like to call sociocultural regulation. And finally, you could rightly ask, why care about this? Why care if it is the brainstem or the cerebral cortex and how this is made? Three reasons. First, curiosity. Primates are extremely curious, and humans most of all. And if we are interested, for example, in the fact that anti-gravity is pulling galaxies away from the Earth, why should we not be interested in what is going on inside of human beings? Second, understanding society and culture. We should look at how society and culture in the sociocultural regulation are a work in progress. And finally, medicine. Let's not forget that some of the worst diseases of humankind are diseases such as depression, Alzheimer's disease, drug addiction. Think of strokes that can devastate your mind or render you unconscious. You have no prayer of understanding how the of treating those diseases effectively and in a non-serendipitous way if you do not know how this works. So that's a very good reason beyond curiosity to justify what we're doing and to justify having some interest in what is going on in our brains. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, so I'm gonna. So you might want to hear that again. That's Antonio Damasio, D-A-M-A-S-I-O. Go to TED.com and search D-A-M-A-S-I-O, D-A-M-A-S-I-O, because that's totally profound. But let me tell you what he said in 2 seconds. Okay, or not what he said. I'm gonna tell you why this is important. Okay.
For many years, I have been down on myself. Because I couldn't realize the Buddhist ideal of no self, anatta. You know, the idea that you gotta get rid of your ego. And I could get easily to the point where I was in awareness of this stuff going on in my mind. You know, I could watch my mind, but I couldn't get rid of the me watching. It was always me watching my thoughts, feelings, and sensations. I thought, oh, lousy Buddhist, you know, what am I doing? You know, a lousy meditator. Until I realized what neuroscience was saying. He's saying that there are three levels of self. The proto-self is not conscious. It's the level at which the brain stem is always monitoring the body. You don't know about that. It's the constant monitoring of, that the brain stem does of the body. Okay. The core self, the second level, is the level on a conscious level of me in a body. It comes, it's right related to the proto-self. That is, it comes from the brainstem, and those of you who are advanced meditators, you realize that your awareness comes from your brainstem. It doesn't come from up here. Up here is up there from where you're actually looking. So the looking, the me that's always looking, is the core self, which is simply a viewpoint in a body, a constant viewpoint in a body. Whenever you're conscious, you're looking from this viewpoint. You always have, when you were 5 years old, you were still looking from this viewpoint. When you're 95, you're going to be looking from this viewpoint. This morning, it's the same viewpoint. That's you. That's the you that's always constant. Your thoughts change, your feelings change, your sensations change, but you're always you. It's always the looking that's defining you. That's from the brainstem. That's the core self. The autobiographical self is all the stories you tell about yourself based on what you your past. It's the stuff that you say, I'm good at this, I'm bad at that, I like this, I don't like that. That's the ego. That's the overlay of stories you say to yourself rather than the simple fact of being conscious. So what, on one level, what the Buddhists are saying is, if you get rid of being governed by those stories, you're a lot freer to be who you are, right, to be naturally who you are right at this moment. It's the stories that constrain you. So one level of no self is getting rid of those stories. And we, many of us, can do that. You know, we can sit and meditate and we can watch the me show rather than being the me show. So the difference between ego and self is, I think, a basic difference to understand. The self, the ego is the stories we tell ourselves. The self is simply the awareness in each moment that is our perspective. Now, is there a possibility of going further and actually getting rid of this perspective, this watching in every moment? I used to think that was something for super advanced meditators, and next week I'm going to tell you about super advanced meditators. You know, enlightened people. But it turns out we all have this experience all the time. Whenever you get absorbed by something and you forget about yourself, you have gone beyond the me looking at it, the duality of my perspective on life. When does this happen? When you read. There's no you. You're not looking, thinking, I'm looking at the paper. There's only what you're reading. When you watch a video and it absorbs you, it's only the video. At given moments, there's only a perception. And then there's the me story that comes after that. So this, those of you who have flow experiences where you get lost in something for hours at a time, you forget about yourself, there's a unification of the doing, the doer and the doing, of the thing being, the perceiver and the thing being perceived. There's no more duality between me looking at it. There's simply only that, the activity happening. That's enlightenment. That's one point in mind. That's no duality. That's no ego and no self. So that's the deeper level of anatta, no self. And we all experience it all the time. Just the people that are enlightened, they walk around with that experience. We just have it occasionally. So this makes sense to people? I mean, this is so important, the idea that there are three levels of possibility. Your one level is your story, which can drive you crazy. The second level is just you being alive, having a story but not being governed by it. And then the level of not even me, just a unification with whatever is transpiring, whatever is happening. Those are the three levels of self, non-self and non-self. All right, this is to be continued next week. I know that this was a lot really quick, but we're certainly going to go further with it next week, okay? Mike.
And next week, perhaps we can comment on the dilemma that I have with Buddhism and escaping from the ego. As he points out, this autobiographical self leads to ego, leads to culture, leads to science and medicine and everything.
It's not a bad thing. It's made human beings human beings. It's wonderful. But when it's not okay, when what's happening is not okay, you need to fix that.
But we have a cerebral cortex. We keep running around like creatures that don't have any thinking.